Scott and Rick.
I don't really have a lot to comment on.
Danny and Sunday have crashed. They've gone into each other.
I wasn't listening.
No idea what you were speaking about.
This is the F1 Podcast. Two soft compounds.
Hello there. I am Scott Hughes.
I'm Rick Horton.
And we are the two soft compounds off the back of the Eiffel Grand Prix, which actually turned out to be quite a little race in the end. And he's finally done it. He's equaled Michael Schumacher's record-winning number, which is 91 Grand Prix for Lewis Hamilton. So he's finally done it. Ironically, as we said last week on the podcast, he's done it in Germany. Great to see Mick Schumacher giving him one of Michael's helmets as well. So it was all very respectfully done with Hamilton taking the helmet on the podium as well. But yeah, he's finally there. 91 Grand Prix wins.
Yeah, it was a bit of a damp squib, the start to the weekend, wasn't it, with the whole of Friday practice being cancelled because of low cloud and the medical helicopter unable to fly. I felt really quite sorry for Mick Schumacher and Callum Ilott, who would have got their first outing in an FP1 Formula One session, but obviously that wasn't to be. Callum Ilott especially, because he was so excited on his Instagram and Twitter accounts leading up to the weekend. But then, of course, on Saturday, we got running and we saw Valtteri Bottas take another pole position. And I thought, you know, this could be Valtteri's weekend. Sadly, not to be. And also, in the race itself, there were so many weird retirements for technical problems that we haven't seen en masse for a long, long time.
Yeah, it was very strange that, because, you know, like you say, it's not like it's not a famous, you know, car breaking circuit. We're sort of well over halfway into the season now, aren't we, with the development and all that kind of stuff. So it was very strange seeing all the cars kind of just dropping out as they were. It was also strange to see Stroll not take part in the Grand Prix, I thought. It was, you know, I think from the gist I got from the telly reports is he had a bit of an upset stomach, which is not ideal, I suppose, driving a racing car. But I thought that was quite interesting that he just basically said, yeah, no, I can't take part in it this weekend. So Hülkenberg got another go in the car as well. And again, Hülkenberg, I mean, he's a great driver, isn't he? Just turns up. He turned up in his lovely Porsche, which I saw in the pit lane. Gets up, gets the, you know, his kit on, gets his helmet on, gets in the car. Obviously didn't have a great qualifying, but, you know, I thought he did really well in the race. And he's certainly sort of waving his arms around in the air for a drive next year, isn't he, saying, I'm still here and I'm still ready for this. I thought he did very well.
Yeah, he's putting himself in the shop window without a doubt. Gets the call 11 a.m. on Saturday morning, so he misses FP3, gets to the circuit. He was supposed to be working for German television, so he was kind of on his way anyway. But gets in the car for the first time during qualifying, which is just bizarre. So he hasn't done any simulator work on that track. Last time he drove that car was back in Silverstone, which seems like an age away. And he got in the car and, yeah, all right, he was last in qualifying. But what a race he had. Really good, getting a points finish. Hülkenberg definitely in the shop window. But someone pointed it out on social media. They said, well, if they're thinking of... Because the rumours going round this morning, actually, that Red Bull might be looking at Hülkenberg to be partner with Max Verstappen next year in favour of dropping Alex Albon. And then you look at Hulk's record, and he's a great, consistent driver, but he's still never been on the podium in, what, 12 years of racing in Formula One. So Albon has been on the podium, you know, and it just baffles me, really, how Hülkenberg is a consideration for the Red Bull team. You would almost certainly have him in a car like Haas, or maybe even in the Racing Point, because, you know, he's a good, consistent driver with lots of experience. But would you want him in one of the top three teams? I think that's probably a different question.
Yeah, I mean, there's half of me that thinks he deserves a top three drive. He deserves one of the top teams to show what he can do in one of the better cars. There's another half of me going, yeah, he's had his time. He's had his, you know, like you say, his 12 years or whatever it has been. And a young guy needs to get a chance now. The Albon Gasly thing is weird as well, because I think Gasly has had an amazing season this year. He's proved that he's a great driver. And once the pressure's off him, you know, he's kind of come back on form. He had that win, obviously. And he's really shown that he can drive a great car this year. And he's had a really good season. Albon has gone the other way, where last year was amazing in that car. And this year he's struggling a lot. I think the pressure's hit him that he's in a top team. And he's now, it's that whole spiral thing, isn't it? Of you're worrying about losing your drive, and then your brain gets involved, and then you panic, and then you start driving rubbish. And that's kind of happening to him. Red Bull are very famous for not really giving anybody a chance. So they put you in the car, you got a few races to get up to speed, and in their eyes, if you're not another Verstappen, then, you know, you shouldn't be in the car. The problem they've got is there's no one really coming up and no one really coming through, is there? And you've got, you know, they've all got their driver programs. Ferrari have got one, Red Bull have got one, you know, they've all got these young driver programs, and the idea being obviously they bring those drivers through the ranks. And I think Red Bull are going for a period where, you know, they've had many, many drivers. I can think of years when they had, you know, four or five options to put in the car for the next year. And we're in a period now where they haven't really got any options. It was interesting to see Rosberg talking on Sky Sports over the weekend, basically saying, you know, he was quizzing Paul de Resta and asking about it. And de Resta kind of alluded to the fact that Gasly's fallen out with somebody high up in Red Bull. So he doesn't think he's going to be, you know, welcome back in that team. Has Albon done enough to stay in that team? Do they swap them back again? Do they bring someone new in? And then, of course, they've got all the engine stuff as well, the Honda engine leaving. And so they've, you know, Red Bull have got a real headache couple of sort of 18 months ahead of them, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And I was disappointed with Alex Albon because I thought he hit the ground running when he got the drive in the Red Bull car at the Belgian Grand Prix onwards from last season. I thought he did really well towards the end of 2019. And then this year, you know, he just hasn't really been up to par. I know that Verstappen is, you know, a faster driver by all accounts. And I know that their updates have been favouring Verstappen. They've been giving him the upgraded cars and the upgraded parts for different race weekends and using Albon as a bit of a guinea pig at times. But he still hasn't really shown what I thought was a big potential. And yet the Gasly thing, I heard that rumour that he'd upset someone in Red Bull. So I'm thinking Marco or Christian Horner, I would imagine, or someone, either with comments or something he's done. So maybe that's not an option. But of course, Red Bull have always looked at their young driver programme. And now, like you say, they really don't have that as an option if they want a competent driver alongside Max for the 2021 season.
Yeah, and I think with Albon as well, whenever I watch him getting interviewed and stuff like that, he seems a bit too nice. And it's very weird to say that because, you know, I don't think anybody can ever be too nice. I think it's a great quality to have in life. But as a Formula One driver and as a racer, it's not a great quality because you need a bit of selfishness. You need, you know, you see it all the time with Verstappen and Hamilton. When it doesn't go their way, they sulk. When the engineers tell them stuff on the radio, they go against it and they say, no, we're doing it my way. And you've almost got to have a little bit of that in you, you know, to get on in Formula One. Alonso's another great example of someone that will do it his own way and get snotty on the radio and throw his toys out the pram. And I think if you're not that kind of driver, you struggle when you get to this kind of level. And as I said, I just think Albon, sometimes when I see him getting interviewed, he just seems too nice, too friendly, too placid. And I think he almost needs to do, you know, he needs to go out on track and go crazy. It's the same story with Bottas, you know. He needs that edge to him. He needs that kind of aggressive, I'm going to beat you at all costs edge. And I don't think he's got it either against Hamilton. And this is the problem, I think, with all those kind of drivers. They're just not got that right kind of grit to them to get them to the top.
Yeah, what was interesting was Rosberg, who was talking on the Sky coverage, and he was saying, when it comes to Bottas, this was before the race, he was saying, look, if you look at Hamilton, he threw his toys out of the pram in Russia, didn't finish on the podium. He threw his toys out of the pram because he had a penalty in Monza, didn't finish on the podium. He said, these are the opportunities where, as his teammate challenging for the world title, you have to grab those times. Because when he's down, he's vulnerable. And when he's winning all the time, he's confident and he just oozes, you know, world championship status. But when he has a bit of a dip or a lull, either because of a mechanical problem or because of an error, which we saw in Monza and Russia, that's the time to strike. And he said Bottas needs to grab this opportunity because he won't get many. Maybe one dip a season for Lewis Hamilton seems to be the norm. And if he doesn't grab it by the horns, then he's never going to beat Hamilton. And obviously that's what Rosberg made the most of in that 2016 season when he became world champion.
Yeah, I found Rosberg, his style, shall we say, on the telly. He likes to kind of drop all these little bombs, doesn't he? And you can see him almost smirking to himself. He'll drop a comment and then he'll just kind of walk away smirking as if to say, I'll leave that one with you guys to work out. But he's, like you say, he's very much throwing these things out. And, you know, he's a guy that's done it. He has beaten Hamilton. He's beaten the six-time world champion that's going on to be probably the seven-time world champion and maybe even more. You know, he has beat one of the greatest drivers to ever live. So he can kind of have that smirk, I suppose, and have that confidence because he knows what to do and how to do it. He had a couple of years when you could tell it was winding Rosberg up as well. He was trying his best to beat him and he was getting frustrated and angry. And then, like you say, he kind of worked out the sweet spot, and that was to pounce on the mistakes and to mentally wind Hamilton up. And he did it in 2016. And I think that's why he retired. For me, I think he just went, well, look, I'm not going to be able to do this again. I've had a great year. You know, I've won the world title. You know, I've accomplished everything I've ever wanted to do. Maybe I'll go and do some other things now and enjoy life, because he was very young when he retired. And it surprised me when he retired as well. I didn't see that coming. But yeah, he knows what he's doing, and he's trying to tell these other drivers to do exactly the same. But it's interesting to see him just drop these comments and then walk off smiling.
Follow Two Soft Compounds on Twitter and Facebook. Search for Two Soft Compounds.
Right, so before we dissect the race in our opinions as to what happened at the Eiffel Grand Prix, let's get some fascinating stats now. Nicky at Lights Out is our pro stats man, always got some amazing facts and figures, and of course he'll have loads this weekend after Hamilton equals yet another record. Here's Nicky.
Hamilton equals the win record, Renault take their first podium in 9 years, and Grosjean scores for the first time in 2020. Here are some of the top statistics from the Eiffel Grand Prix weekend. Lewis Hamilton equaled Michael Schumacher's win record at the 2020 Eiffel Grand Prix with his 91st victory. Hamilton's win was Mercedes' first win at the Nürburgring since Juan Manuel Fangio was victorious in the 1954 German Grand Prix. Hamilton becomes the ninth different driver to have won multiple Grand Prix at the Nürburgring. Daniel Ricciardo recorded the 30th podium finish of his career and his first podium since the 2018 Monaco Grand Prix. Ricciardo is the first Renault driver to finish on the podium since Nick Heidfeld at the 2011 Malaysian Grand Prix. It's the Enstone team's first podium since Romain Grosjean finished third at the 2015 Belgian Grand Prix. With Ricciardo finishing in the top three for Renault, 2020 is the first season in which seven different teams have finished on the podium since 2012. Max Verstappen joined Hamilton and Ricciardo on the podium. The 2020 Eiffel Grand Prix marks only the third time that a Mercedes engine, a Honda engine and a Renault engine have finished on the podium together. It last happened in 2005 at the German and Belgian Grand Prix. This is the first time that Hamilton, Verstappen and Ricciardo have finished on the podium together since the 2017 Japanese Grand Prix. On that day, just like at the Eiffel Grand Prix, Hamilton won, Verstappen finished second and Ricciardo was third. Next up, some quick-fire stats. Gasly recorded the Red Bull Junior team's first ever points at the Nürburgring. Ferrari failed to finish in the top six at the circuit for the first time since 1999. Super sub Nico Hülkenberg gained 12 places, the most places gained by any driver in any race so far in 2020. Perez equaled the Silverstone-based team's best ever result at the track, and Grosjean scored his first points of the year and became the first driver to score at the Nürburgring, having started 16th on the grid since Gunnar Nilsson in 1976. And finally, some title permutations. Mercedes could wrap up the Constructors' Championship at the Portuguese Grand Prix, though Red Bull would need to encounter some bad luck for them to do so. Mercedes currently lead the way by 180 points. They'll take a seventh consecutive title at the next race if they record a 1-2 finish with Red Bull scoring three or fewer points, or if their drivers finish first and third with Red Bull failing to score.
Nice one, Nicky. You can follow him, as Rick said, across the Grand Prix weekends. He's got some brilliant stats. At Lights Out is where you can find him on Twitter. He's got all his blogs and stuff as well. It's just brilliant every single week. But the Eiffel Grand Prix, so there was some weird stuff that happened as well, wasn't there? We had that weird Vettel spin. We had Kimi hitting Russell, which was very unusual for Kimi. There was the Bottas lockup when Hamilton passed him. We had Albon wiping out Kvyat's wing as well. There was Bottas losing engine power. There was some quite strange things that happened across that Grand Prix, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think the cold probably didn't help. I mean, obviously didn't help with the tyres. I think the air temperature was around 8 or 9 degrees during the race. So obviously the tyres come out of the blankets, but by the time you've got to the end of the pit lane, they're pretty cold, especially if you're on the mediums or the hards. No team had used the hard tyre before the race in any of the practice or qualifying sessions, so they really had no data on those. And I think they were struggling with warming the tyres up, which is why we saw lots of lockups and cars running wide. I have to hand it to Bottas. When the race started, he didn't have the best of starts. Hamilton gets alongside him going down towards turn one, and I just thought, oh, typical Bottas. He's going to let this one go. But he didn't. He kept his foot in and kept the lead and then started pulling out somewhat of a lead before he had the lockup. And then, of course, the engine problems, which happened to a number of drivers. You know, Norris, I thought, had a really difficult job to deal with. He had this engine problem where he was complaining on the radio about no power. It turned out that he had no power in the straights, but decent cornering speed, so they were asking him to go through default menus on his steering wheel every time he came out of a corner. And that must have been more driving a Casio keyboard than it was driving a Formula One car, because he was constantly having to go into menus and sub-menus on the steering wheel. I was listening, for part of the race, I was listening to radio commentary, which is always a weird thing for Formula One, but they have to explain, obviously, everything much more than they would on television, because you don't have the pictures to go with it. And they had Jolyon Palmer was saying that what he's trying to do on the steering wheel there is not a simple fix. It's not like switching a toggle switch. He has to go into a menu and then a sub-menu, scroll through the sub-menu to get to the setting he wants, click enter, click confirm, and he has to do that nearly every single corner. That's a difficult car to drive, and obviously in the end he retired, which was a real shame. I love the way he sat on the deck chair almost and watched the rest of the race. So lots of people having problems with engines. Albon one was weird as well, because there was nothing on the radio to suggest that he had a power problem. He didn't go on the radio once and say low power, or the team didn't come on the radio and say you need to manage this situation, or, you know, switch to default three or whatever they would do.
On top of all the kind of retirements and that sort of stuff, there seem to be a lot of drivers that changed engines. I noticed at the start of the race, they were saying, you know, that's a new engine in that car, new engine in that car. And it seemed to be that an awful lot of the drivers had changed engines. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not. But like you say, just a very bizarre race that we're over halfway through the season. You know, these engines are not brand new. They know what they're doing with these engines now. And there just seem to be some really bizarre kind of issues with all these cars. And yeah, I mean, Lando, it's incredible when you think about him doing that every corner. You can't think of a better driver to do it, because he's from the generation where they play computer games. And, you know, if it's an older driver like a Kimi, or a Hamilton, someone like that, they might have struggled a bit more with that. But, you know, I think with Lando, it all just comes a bit natural to that generation, doesn't it? But I found it interesting as well that Hamilton was saying when he equaled the record at the end, that he said, I used to play the Formula One racing games, and I was always Schumacher, or sometimes I was even you, Coulthard, when he was interviewing him. But interesting that, you know, that kind of era of driver played on a PlayStation and played the Formula One games kind of before they got into Formula One. But obviously once they got into Formula One, they had the real thing to drive, so the computer games weren't an interest to them. But the modern era, I mean, your Gaslys, your Albons, your George Russells, your Landos, all you see on social media is those guys on these amazing simulators. I think I said last week on the show, I looked one of these simulators up. I'm like, oh, that's a great bit of kit when I get one of those in my house. And it was £53,000. So that ended that dream quite rapidly. But some of these simulators now are just incredible, with a little chair and they vibrate and just incredible stuff. But they've all got them in their houses.
Unbelievable. And another thing I thought was interesting about Hamilton was Angela, who's Hamilton's physio. You always see they're like two peas in a pod. I'm surprised she doesn't sit in the car with him whilst he drives the race, because she's with him every single second of the day outside the car. She's got the blonde hair. She's the one that leans into the car and does his straps up, and she's the one who does his physio, and she's always with him as sort of a personal assistant. She said after the race, and she released a statement to say, you know, congratulations to Lewis on equaling this Schumacher record. I have to say his work ethic is amazing. He's always the last driver to leave the circuit in the evening. He pours over data with Bono and the engineers. He'll go through a replay of the entire race in the evening after the race, before they leave the garage. They'll go through and analyse every single corner, every single mistake or late braking move that he makes, and he'll back that up by looking at the pictures and correlate it to the data. And that's what he's been doing over so many years, which is what makes him a worthy world champion. I thought that was quite interesting. I always got the impression that Hamilton was an amazing driver. I knew he studied data, but not at that sort of degree, because Hamilton is the sort of driver that doesn't smack me of sitting in a simulator in his bedroom for 6 hours a day, whereas some of the younger ones do. But clearly, he really studies his craft, and he wants to get better from every little nuance he can pull out of the car and his own performance.
Yeah, and like you said, that's good to hear that, because you look at these drivers and you think, you know, they're subhuman. How can they do what he's doing in that race car? And it kind of angers you a little bit when you get in a go-kart and you can't do anything anywhere near what they can do. But it's good to hear that, because that to me tells me that he's worked for it, he's worked hard. You know, he's really kind of got his head down and got involved. And that's how you get better, isn't it? Practice, practice, practice. So the fact he's going over that data is great. It's the first thing he said, actually, when he was being interviewed. They said, you know, what happened in this moment? And he said, oh, I don't know, I'll have to look at the data and find out, you know. And I think he said something about, I'll have to see, you know, Bottas's data versus mine and see where he was quicker, because he was pulling away. And, you know, like you say, he's constantly thinking about the next race, you know, how he can be better. And, you know, just even the systems that these cars have now, you know, a lot of people, I think I saw a quote the other day that basically said, oh, you know, these cars are so easy to drive now. All they do is steer and press the pedals and that's it. And, you know, these Formula One drivers were like, you know, you have no idea how complex these steering wheels are. They have to basically take an exam on how to work the steering wheel, don't they? Like you said, menus and sub-menus. And you see these, you see the steering wheels, they've got switches with like 12 settings on each switch. And then each switch has 12 yeah. sub-settings. And then in those 12 sub-settings, there's another 12 sub-settings, you know, and you have to basically read a manual. And when a driver goes from one team to another, they have to learn the new steering wheel and learn where all these systems are. And, you know, and sometimes you hear it on the radio, don't you, where, oh, can you put default 17 on? It's in submenu 6 or whatever. And they're doing 200 miles an hour trying to find submenu 6 to put default 6 on. It's crazy what they can do.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting comparison with Hamilton and Schumacher. Schumacher was the first driver to have any kind of digital steering wheel, if you remember, when he was back in the winning things in the Ferrari. I mean, back then, it was literally a digital rev counter and a couple of adjustments he could make in the car. They were still making brake bias adjustments, if you remember, by leaning down to pull a lever at the side of the cockpit. Schumacher was the first driver to kind of design his steering wheel so that he had the controls he needed at his fingertips, and the digital rev counter and then the lap time display. He was the first to have that. And I remember listening to Murray Walker when we were sort of in 2003, 2004 saying, this steering wheel cost £50,000 and Schumacher's designed it himself and blah, blah, blah. And we've come a long way since then. But the comparison to Hamilton was that apparently Hamilton sits down for months before each new season and designs his steering wheel for that year with the engineers. So he doesn't just let them get on with it. He has a massive input into where certain controls are going to be, what he thinks he's going to need in the next season to achieve the best result in the car. And he puts a lot of time into that as well. So again, devotion to the craft is a big thing for Lewis Hamilton, as it was for Michael Schumacher. And of course, both of them have produced these amazing results, which has equaled each other's 91 wins.
Yeah, and obviously in my mind, you know, Hamilton's going to go on to win more races even this year. And yeah, he's pretty much nailed on to win his seventh world championships now. He's nearly three wins ahead, I think, isn't he? Nearly three wins clear. So he could afford, in theory, three DNFs and could still win the title. So he's, you know, he's in a great position at the moment. Anything can happen because we're only just halfway over the season, but it's been a really good season so far. And the next race, of course, is in Portugal, the Portuguese Grand Prix, which I'm excited about.
Yeah, Portimao, it's a track I know very little about. They've used it in MotoGP before. I guess it's got the gravel runoff areas, which is good. Oh, an interesting point on that as well. They're redesigning or they're redeveloping Spa in Belgium. And they're putting a new grandstand at the top of Eau Rouge, which looks as though it's going to be great. And they're not reprofiling the track as such because we don't want to lose those iconic corners. But they are, based on what they've seen this season, apparently, reinstating gravel traps at the Belgian Grand Prix. And I think that's been a big plus of going to these new circuits this year, having the gravel traps. If you make a mistake and put your car off road, you're out of the race. It's no more spinning it round on the tarmac runoff. You're out of the race. And I think that makes it more exciting as a spectator, and it gives the drivers more pressure on track to not make those errors that normally they would have gotten away with. So I think that's quite exciting. And Portimao, as I understand it, has the gravel runoffs. We're all going to see that at Imola as well when we go there later in the year. And the Turkish Grand Prix, tarmac runoffs, but still a great track. So this season's just thrown up some really good stuff.
Touching on the tracks as well, the other thing that I found really interesting this year is the fact that we've gone to these tracks where the teams have no data. The drivers sometimes have never driven at these tracks. And it's the added element of, right, I've got to learn the track this weekend. I've got to learn it and then get fast and then do qualifying. Then I've got to race. You know, then I've got to work out where the gravel is and where not to go off and where I can go off. And, you know, the extra challenge of all that that the drivers have faced as well, I think has been really, really good this year. And I know a few people have said it in the commentary and stuff. Maybe we should rotate some of these races. You know, maybe we should come back to some of these tracks and rotate them. Because I think that's the other thing. The drivers get used to, you know, there's 20 Grand Prix that don't change that often. So they know what, you know, what tracks they're going to. They can practice at home. They can get used to these tracks. They can race at these tracks beforehand and they get very comfortable with these tracks. And I think mixing it up and not knowing where they're going next and, you know, they're using a different track at this race than they are at this race. And, you know, this is great and gravel and all that kind of stuff. It's just kept it really alive this year. And I think what could have been a disastrous 2020 has actually turned out to be a really good season. So it's been great. But yeah, Ferrari, like you say, doing well. I think Leclerc is just driving the absolute wheels off that car. Vettel has completely lost his mojo in that team, and I can completely understand that. I do think he's going to get in the Aston Martin next year and will come alive again. It'll be a new challenge for him, and I think we'll see a different Vettel again next year, which is, you know, a bit of a shame to see to end his Ferrari career like that. But Leclerc, just incredible. And, you know, you give him a decent car, he's going to be a multiple world champion, Leclerc, without a doubt.
Yeah, and a new engine coming next season for Ferrari, they confirmed this weekend, which they say they're quite excited about. They said there wasn't going to be a major upgrade until 2022, but it looks like they've redesigned their engine and power unit, which will be ready for next season. So they could be challenging sooner than we thought. Right, I'm going to go back to polishing my helmet because I have a race tonight. I'm racing in the regional final of the UK Indoor Karting Championship, which sounds exciting until you realise I've been put in the super heavyweights category, which basically means I'm rather overweight.
Well, good luck in that tonight. Hope it goes well. Fingers crossed for you.
Don't eat any dinner before you go. Yeah, I'll let you know on next week's podcast how I get on. Could be an absolute disaster. Right, that's it from us. We'll be back next week to preview Portimão and the Portuguese Grand Prix, the next round of the Formula One World Championship.
Follow Two Soft Compounds on Twitter and Facebook. Search for Two Soft Compounds. Two Soft Compounds is a talk about media production. All opinions are our own.